Our speaker today is a real special young lady. It's real neat when you find these kids that are involved in service work. She's been involved with the Conference of Loving Alateen, served on Alateen Board of Directors. She's been real instrumental in keeping the conference going. She's a very lovely young lady. Always got a smile. So neat. Bill W. wrote in the big book when he was talking about, I believe, Bill D. I'm not sure, but I think it was Bill D. he was talking about. He said, but he had found God, and in finding God, found himself. And this is such a powerful program because that's where we live, in the heart of God, I believe. Not because I want to be there, but because God put me there. And all I need to do is open up my spiritual eyes when we became aware of God's presence. And this young lady, I can see her through her eyes into her soul, and God lives there. I give you hope.
There are entirely too many people in here, so I'm asking a few of y'all to leave. I'm kidding. My name is Hope, and I'm a member of Alateen.
Hi, Hope.
Hey, people. Be quiet. Let's see. I think I grew up in this program because I went to my first AA meeting when I was 3 weeks old. Mama carried me in there. And so that's, you know, I don't remember much about when I was little, but I knew it was kind of bad. But the word alcoholic was a good thing because I was proud of it, because it was good because Mama was in recovery and she was okay. I don't remember what I've been told. I think it's funny. I gotta tell it. I went to the grocery store one day, and we were talking to the cashier person, and I said, my mama's an alcoholic, and I'm real proud of this. And Mama kind of says, in recovery, but the lady still looks at us like we're just really crazy people, because, you know, anyway, so I'm real proud of, because from what I see, what an alcoholic is you're a happy person because they're not drinking anymore, and the term alcoholic was a wonderful thing, but I always forgot to put recovery in front of it, so... Well, anyway, I don't remember much about, my mom was married to a person, my mom was married to my dad, and I really don't remember him very much, but, because I haven't talked or heard from him in about 12 years, I just know that when I was about 5 years old, that maybe a year or two earlier than that, it was pretty bad. So Mom and I left. So we lived on our own for a couple of years. We moved around a lot when I was little, because we didn't have very much money, and we were kind of hopping around from place to place. And we ended up living with my grandparents, and I've been told that when I was 5 years old, that I told my mama to stop lying to me about where my daddy was, because she would buy presents, you know, and put his name on it, and I was, you know, I knew that it wasn't really from him, but I probably said, oh, how sweet, just to make her happy. And so I told her that, we're at my grandmother's house, and this is where I actually remember the stuff. So we're doing good. We're getting along with my grandparents. It's kind of crowded, but we're getting along. And so my mama, she's a wonderful person. She meets this wonderful guy, the best man in the world. She meets him, and he comes to pick her up one day. I think it's like the second date or the third date or something around there. And he comes, picks her up, from my grandma, we're in my grandma's house. He comes to say hi. I meet him for the first time, and he says hi to me. I'm like, hi, and he's really, really cute. He's real cute. And and after they leave, I turn to my grandmother, and I said, he's the one, isn't he? She's like, you think so? I said, uh-huh. He's going to be the one. And sure enough, he was. And my mom was still sober at this time. And he drank a little bit, but not very much, or so I thought. And he drank at night. And then I think he started drinking a little more. My mom got pregnant with my little brother, and I think that kind of. And when she had him, he was premature, and that kind of stressed them out. Before that, gotta tell you this. I came home. I was going. We had moved. They got married. We moved into his house, and I was going to school. I come home from school one day, and my mom was had stayed home from work for some reason, and she was sitting in the little recliner watching TV, and she was drinking something. And I asked her what it was, and she said, oh, it's not alcoholic. Right. I believed it then, but no, she had started drinking again. But I didn't really get it until later. Okay, so she has my brother, and they're getting stressed out because he was real sick for the first 2 years. He's in another hospital 7 times in his first 2 years of life, and he's wonderful now, but he was real sick, and that started stress and put stress, a lot of stress on the family. And so, yeah, my dad loses his job that he had for 18 years, and I think his drinking progressively got worse. He was able to get another job, but he was only there for just a short time because they told him to leave because of his drinking. And then he actually got another job and kept it for a little while. And during the summer of 3 years ago, whatever year that was, I was at home, of course, and school hadn't started yet. And he comes home, and it was about lunchtime, and my mom smokes, and she smokes outside because I don't like it, and she smokes outside, and I don't want it inside. So she was outside, sitting outside smoking, and my dad comes in, he says hi to me, and he walks outside. I'm playing on the computer, and he sits out there for quite a long time. And what he was doing was he had known that my mom had been in the program before, and what he was doing was his boss had earlier that day had said, you need to do something, or you know, you're gonna not be here anymore. He had gone outside, and he asked my mom for help, and that they talked about an hour. They came inside, and he went back to his room, and I guess he packed his bag or something, or she did or something, and they left, and they went to a treatment center, and they were gone for a pretty long time. And so I sat in the house by myself, looking at the half-empty vodka bottle. I didn't know what to do with it. Like, do I want to slam it against the wall? Do I want to pour it down the drain? What do I want to do with it? So I just left it there and just stared at it and thought about it. My mom comes back, and she explains to me what was going on. And one of my dad's fears was that, because this was in early August, late July, early August. And when he was naive, I guess, and only heard of 30 days in treatment, and he was scared that he was going to miss my brother's birthday and my first day of high school. And I really thought that was really sweet that he thought of that. So he was in treatment for a week, 10 days, something like that. And he came home, and that night, my mom took her last drink, and so they were both sober on the same day, and have 3 years. So I'm really proud of that. But I was really happy for them that they'd gotten sober and everything, but there was still something wrong with me. I wasn't as happy as I thought I should be. So about 6 months later, in February, my mom told me about our team, and I went to a group at St. Philip's, and I was the only one there because my friend had schoolwork to do, because in February teachers like to give big projects and stuff. So Susanna, she was there. She had some school stuff to do. So for the first couple of weeks, I was there by myself with this wonderful guy, and I just told my story to him, and he helped me to learn what this was about. And then Anna finally came, and so I got to identify with Anna, and she has been one of my really good friends these past couple of years, and I don't think I would have made it through without her. I probably wouldn't be here today if it weren't for this program. And so I got here. It saved my life. It's a wonderful thing for any new people in here. It's great. I learned a lot about myself through it. One of my favorite things is to, our group has really grown. It used to be 2 people, and then 3, and then 5, and then it was back down to like 3. But last Monday, we had about 10 people in there, and I was really, really, really proud of that. So, and I was able to go to the international convention, AA convention in Minneapolis, and one of the things, I went into the Alateen room and was asked to be on the panel there. Like, okay, my first time in front of anybody was at the International Convention. That's kind of a big deal. And where was I going with that? I forgot where I was going to go with that. Oh, one of the topics of discussion was how people are afraid of Alateens. They don't understand why we're here, and Alateen was kind of real big, and I noticed that it had started not being real big, and I think with that convention, it helped a lot of people go back home and start up groups, because I've heard from some people that I met there through my email, and they've started some groups, and Alateen isn't dying anymore, because I was really thinking, because we didn't have a lot of people, and it was just it's growing now, and people are starting to understand what it's all about. I totally forgot what I was going to say here. So I've been here. I'll be here almost 3 years in February. Through this program, I've met a lot of people. I think I've been able to help a lot of people, because I like the fact that that I'm not the only one. People know what I'm going through, just like in all the other programs. This is just a wonderful thing, and I'm very proud to serve on the COLA board and go to DSAC, and I spoke at DSAC this past time. And it was a really wonderful experience, and I encourage, if any of you have children, to get them involved, because it is very wonderful, and it's a great thing. Okay, I'm going to talk about some recovery. One of my defects is I'm a people pleaser, and I constantly ask what's wrong if somebody doesn't look the right way or they're not acting the right way. So that's something I'm working on, is to realize that I'm not the problem when somebody's upset, because I hate it when anybody's mad at me, because it's just, it's not really a good feeling when somebody's mad at you. And it's just, I'm okay. And so that's one of the things I'm working on. It's one of, probably, I don't know if you rate defects of character or things, but that's kind of like my worst one, because I'm all the time, if somebody doesn't look the right way, what's wrong with you? What did I do to you? And that's not right. That, you know, it's just something I need to work on. And, you know, one of my favorite slogans is first things first, so I want to do everything at once, and you can't do that. You know, so don't think you can do everything at once, you know. I'm starting my senior year, and I'm going to have to learn how to do that, because last year, I didn't put a lot of things. I didn't have my priorities in order, because I went through a lying spill last year. And I had a wreck, and last year was, my junior year was just not good. And I failed the class. I mean, it was awful, and I'm usually an A/B student, and I failed the class. I probably shouldn't have been taking the class anyway, but it was pre-calculus, and it's, I shouldn't have been taking the class anyway, but I failed it because I wasn't focused on it. But so I'm having to relearn some of the things I thought I already learned, and I think that's good, because you never graduate, so I don't have to leave here, because I love this program so much. And I love all of you guys, because you make me smile and make me happy. Like, I was thinking there was going to be some kind of a smart-ass person stand up and walk when I said, get out, and when I said there were too many people in there, I figured, but nobody did, so that was good. And some of the people I talked, some of my friends, they know where I am, and they ask me why I'm still here, because I don't live with active alcoholism anymore. And I said, well, I didn't say it to them, but I thought about it. But I said, my parents may not be drinking anymore, but they're still bitchy. They, you know. Sorry, Mom. I mean, alcoholics, even though they're in recovery, they can still be just as bitchy as ever. So, I'm a senior, I'm around a lot of drinking, I'm going to be in college next year. I was in college this summer, and there was a lot of stuff going on there, so I'm going to be around it just because of my age. So I'm glad that I have this, and all of you, and I'm not really a long speaker, so I'm going to tell you that I love you, and thank you for being here. And maybe I'll see you guys someday soon.
Hi, my name is Maria, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Maria.
And I've been a member of Al-Anon since the 13th of April, 1985. I'm the baby in the group of these speakers. And just to let you know, I am a fill-in speaker for the woman who couldn't make it. So you don't need to have any expectations. I thank God for bringing me into this fellowship in 1985, and it literally saved my life. And I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Hugh for calling me and asking me to come here. When he called me, when I first heard him on the phone, I thought it was somebody playing a joke. I thought it was somebody talking like Wolfman Jack. And I was like, you know, he's like, hello, Maria, this is you. I'm Jack from Mississippi. And I thought, Wolfman Jack is, I thought, is it a singing birthday telegram? I didn't know what it was. And I thought, it's Mr. Rock and Roll calling me. And then I met Hugh with his purple suspenders, and I knew I was right. I like those troublemaking alcoholics with the twinkly eyes. And I want to thank James for manipulating the whole situation so that I was here. And I want to thank Elizabeth for being such a great hostess. A lot of times, you know, I've met some people sometimes, and they meet you at the airport, and then they dump you off, and you never see them again. And it's been really nice that Elizabeth just immediately became my friend. We just became like girlfriends and just started chatting and yapping. And I want to thank Mark and Frank for being here, even though you're making my heart beat. And Frank started us off so great last night. I just loved hearing him talk. I just thought that was so awesome. And then Hope this morning blew me away. I was crying from the first line when she started. I woke up yesterday morning, and knowing I was coming here, I've never been to the South before, and a friend of mine picked me up in her truck and took me to the airport, and got on the plane, and once we got to Dallas, then we took the tram through Dallas to get through the airport, and then the tram broke down in the tunnel, and then we sat there for a while sweating, and then they fixed the tram, and we continued on, and then we got to the satellite part of the airport where you then get on a bus. And so we got on the bus, and then we made it to the airplane, and then we sat out on the tarmac with no air in the plane for about a half an hour. So I don't know why they called it an airplane, but there was no air in the plane. And it was really, really hot in that plane, really hot. And like a little microwave oven us out there. And the seat that I got had paper towels on the floor soaking up somebody's vomit from the previous flight. So my feet were sitting in somebody's vomit, and I'm sitting in this really hot plane, and I'm thinking to myself, I am so happy. I thought, I can handle vomit. I've been around alcoholics all my life. I'm going to Mississippi. And it was so great. And I just thought, these are the little things we get to be grateful for in this program. Never thought I'd be sitting there in a hot plane thinking I was so happy. Then we flew in the turbulence in the prop plane through the thunderstorms. We made it here safely, and then beautiful Elizabeth picked me up. So it was an awesome day, and then I got to hear Frank have dinner with everybody. Okay, no more boring stuff. Well, yeah, there's a lot more boring stuff, but no more boring recent stuff. I grew up in a family that drank a lot, but I can't call them alcoholics because it's a self-diagnosed disease, and alcoholics call themselves alcoholics. But my whole life was around the bar in our house. And I was the bartender from the early age, and my parents had a side business of a beer and wine distributorship. So this always makes the alcoholics salivate, but we had every week kegs of beer delivered to the house, cases of hard liquor and wine. There was beer on tap, and this big wheel that they got in Europe that you take these big, I think they were half-gallon bottles, I don't know, the big ones or gallon bottles, and you turn them upside down on this wheel, and you put it like in a little cork thing, and then there was a spigot on it, and you fill up the bubble, the glass bubble, and then you turn it the other way, and the hard alcohol pours out of the glass, and you turn the wheel to pick which kind of alcohol you like. So, I told you you'd salivate. Anyway, I was the bartender, and I knew how to make my mom's martinis, and I knew how to pour the glass without making too much foam on the top, and I loved it, and there was never any gunfire in my living room, and I wasn't, you know, picking people up and putting them to bed. I don't have that kind of story, and so when I got here, I at first thought, you know, do I fit in, especially because I had that superiority, self-righteous thing going as two of my major defects of character. Hope was talking this morning about rating defects of character. Yes, I rate mine too, and those were definitely two of my favorites. And so I thought, you know, maybe I don't fit in here. But I found out that that's not true, that I fit into Al-Anon, and I need Al-Anon because of my isms. And I have those defects of character that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing is, for me, alcohol never worked to fix me. I drank, I smoked pot, I did all the partying thing when I was a teenager with all the kids. It didn't work. I didn't get that people talk about from the podiums of AA. I didn't feel the wheels of the machine get lubricated. I didn't feel that sense of belonging or I love you, or the feeling of being okay with the world, or having courage, or having the ability to function. I had the same fear, I have the same insecurity, I have the same self-loathing, I have the same not feeling a part of, I have the same, you know, what are you thinking about me, ego, 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 mixed in with the ego of actually trying to change other people. And yet, that I was not relieved by taking something from a glass. It just didn't work for me. So Al-Anon is a place for people like me to go, people that have the same terror, the same bewilderment, the same feelings of uselessness and self-pity and all of those things, and can come here, and we have 12 steps too, and we have a program too, and we can read the big book too, and we can read the AA 12 and 12. Our traditions in Al-Anon state that our primary purpose, our only purpose, is to welcome and give comfort to families of alcoholics. And then it gives the way that we do that. And one of the ways that we do that, it says we do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves. The 12 steps of AA are in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the AA 12 and 12. And that was the kind of program that was given to me growing up in this fellowship. I grew up not wanting for anything materially, and I basically had a pretty good childhood, except for the fact that I was in it. And I was a really solitary kid. I grew up in the world of Nancy Drew. I loved reading. I loved mysteries. I wanted to be a detective, which is kind of like a pre-Al-Anon, you know, detective pre-Al-Anon. Which way should I go? I don't know. Should I chase criminals or chase alcoholics? I went that way. Anyway, so I used to, my games were, I would go through the park, and I would hide behind the bushes and walk along the bushes, and I would take notes on what everybody was saying. I would go into stores and look for shoplifters. If someone drove too quickly, I'd take their license plate number down because I was sure that they had done something wrong and I was going to catch them when they announced it on the evening news. And that was another one of my things that when I put myself to sleep with those hero fantasies or the martyr fantasies, that's when I always knew that I was in a really low place and not feeling a lot of self-worth. And it started from a very young age. I was always having these fantasies about being the hero and calling the police, and I was the one that was going to save the day. And I just felt pretty less than as a kid, and I don't know why. That's just who I am. And when I was about 7 years old, this thing was born, and it was my sister. And I was 7 and a half, and I had been an only child at 7 and a half, and then all of a sudden this little blonde baby came into my life, and she was getting my parents' attention, and she was getting, you know, everybody's attention. And I just didn't know what to make of that, because, again, my low self-worth causes me to act out my defects of character, and one of my biggest defects of character is competition, and that little baby was my competition, because that's somebody that has a lack of faith. You know, I believed in God, but belief and faith are different, and trust are different. And I had a lack of faith, and I didn't believe, I didn't have the faith in a higher power, in a God, as I choose to call him, that there was enough love to go around in the universe. I didn't believe that there was enough abundance. I didn't believe that there was enough caring. So I was, one of my defects of character is competition. And I was in competition with that baby, and I didn't like her. And she didn't like me, she has grown up to call herself an alcoholic, and the only time we've ever had a relationship has been the time that she's been in Alcoholics Anonymous, because my sister went on to go to a mental institution and have a lot of bad things happen to her as a result of her personality, and it turned out later that she was an alcoholic. I had my first boyfriend when I was in kindergarten, and the relationship developed when we were in first grade, and his name was Patrick, and Patrick was it for me, and we used to play kiss in the closet, where he would start at one end of the coat closet, and I would start at the other end, and we had this, like, glow-in-the-dark cream, and we'd put dots on our faces, and we'd find each other in the closet, and then we'd go, and we'd kiss each other, and that was it. I was there. And we used to play tag on the playground, and he used to chase me. And I loved that feeling of being chased. And I haven't had that feeling since then. But what I can remember of it was fantastic. And I've been pursuing wanting to recreate that feeling to the gates of insanity or death for the rest of my life, let me tell you. And I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. When I was 19, I'm going to skip ahead, because I'm sure I'll jump around a lot. When I was 19 years old, I was at a point in my life where I had gotten a job because someone had recommended me and lied about my age. And I'd gotten this job, and it was a big job at a big television network, and I had a big expense account, and I was telling people three times my age what to do and making multi-million dollar deals, and I was a hot shot. They thought I was 25. I had interviewed for the job when I was 19, and I actually got the job when I was 20. But when I was 19 years old was when all of this was taking place, and I had all of this stuff going on the outside and thinking that I was hip, slick, and cool, but on the inside I felt really, really bad about myself, and I was already living a life of, I had searched religion, I had been baptized in a religion, I had done all this stuff as a teenager, I had been looking for the answer, and I had been looking for stuff, I had tried reading those self-help books, I'd gone to therapy, I did all of that stuff, but nobody had my answer. And one night I decided that I was going to be like all those other, you know, little tacky women, and I was going to go to a bar and I was going to pick myself up a one-night stand. You know, if I can't beat him, I'm going to join him. Now, what made me think that that was my first one-night stand, I have no idea, but that's the way I justified it in my mind, you know, because once again, one of my isms was that superiority, inferiority thing, where the worse I felt about myself, the better I had to make myself look and the better I had to make myself feel. And I love what Frank talked about, you know, I wasn't really a lawyer. I was a milkman, but sometimes I look like a lawyer. I love that. That was my outfit, my lawyer outfit. And, you know, the worse I felt about myself, the more I had to pretend that I was something that I wasn't. So I went to this bar to be like those other lower people. And there was a band playing. And I was looking around at those guys, and I thought, I'm going to pick myself one of those guys. And I've always been the eternal audience member. I'm either with a musician or a speaker or a comic or an actor or an athlete or whatever. I'm always sitting in the audience being the one that goes, yay, and then telling them everything they did wrong afterwards. There was a keyboard player there. I looked at all the guys, and, you know, some of them were happy, and one of them was flirting with a girl who turned out to be his wife, and, you know, other things. But there was one guy, and he was blonde, and he had blue eyes where they weren't red, and he was sitting. He had really, really white face, red rings around the eyes, and he was playing the keyboard, and his head was lolling back, and he was kind of like doing a, you know, white Stevie Wonder thing. And I saw him, and I thought, he's really cute. That's the one I'm going to pick. But of course, because I had to be so superior and above all those people that have one night stands, I thought, on their next break, I'm going to just kind of sashay by and listen to his conversation to make sure he's intelligent enough for me. So I went to the bar. He was sitting there talking at the bar, and I heard him talking to this guy, and he was talking about, yes, and then when I was in Europe, I did this, and then we went to, you know, to Amsterdam, we went to this, and we went to that, and I thought, oh, he's talking about Europe. He must be okay. I didn't know the trip was like 25 years before, and he was still talking about it. So I tried to pick him up after they finished playing that night, and he told me, I offered to buy him a drink, and he said he didn't drink. And I saw those red eyes, so I said, oh, do you smoke weed? I didn't know what he did, because he looked so, you know, wasted. And he said, well, actually, I smashed my truck into the front of the Bank of America in Lancashire 25 days ago. And so I stopped drinking, and I go to AA now. And so I knew he didn't have a ride home, so he needed me. And so I gave him a ride home, and we began our 4-year one-night stand. And I went to meetings with that man probably 3 to 5 times a week. And I went to all his gigs with him at night. I was going to my job during the day, and I was absolutely insane. And I would go to these AA meetings, and I would see the alcoholics take their cakes, and I'd go, look, they brought their wife and their baby, and they reunited, and they're giving him his cake, and this is just so great, isn't this wonderful, you know? And then I'd go home, and I'd be like, why aren't you doing this, and why aren't you doing that? And I had the Al-Anon finger out, and you should be doing this, and you, and basically the bottom line was, I'm empty, I have no God in my life, I have no program, I have no faith, therefore I need you to do exactly what I want you to do, when I want you to do it, with the basic function of your life, your brain, and every cell, and every fiber of your damn being focused on wanting you to love me the way I want you to love me now. Which makes me really attractive as a future mate. But the thing is, though, like Chuck Chamberlain talks about, sitting on that chair looking over the the water from Laguna to Catalina and looking at that water and saying, even if that water were alcohol, it still wouldn't be enough. Even if he said, I love you, even if he said, you're the prettiest or you're the sexiest or you're the most wonderful or you're whatever, it still would not be enough. I would do everything that it talks about in the big book. I would still, if he said, I love you, but it was only one time, then I need a double shot. If he said, I love you, but it wasn't the right time, then I need to arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, like it talks about in that big book, to try to get a reaction out of him. That I've got to try to pretend like I don't really want to be with him, or maybe I want to see other people, or maybe I want to do this, just to make sure that he's getting on that hook all the time. Because it's never going to be enough for someone who has an empty, godless soul. And like I said, I had faith in God all my life. I didn't come in here as an agnostic or an atheist. I've searched for God all my life. I went to Sunday school by myself. I made my mom take me to Sunday school, to all different churches, from the time I was 6 years old, by myself, asking about God. I had faith, but I didn't have that belief and I didn't have that trust. I mean, I had the belief, but I didn't have the faith and I didn't have the trust. And I didn't have the tools of action. That faith and trust are really verbs. They're really actions. You know, when I have faith and I have trust in my life, I was taught here to take the right actions in this program. That it's not about getting, it's about giving. The whole St. Francis prayer is really the whole skeleton for life here. And so I would just pummel this poor guy who was trying to stay sober every chance I got. This poor guy, I mean, talk about the grace of God that he is still sober today. I cannot believe he is still sober after being with me for his first 4 years. I mean, they say there are no atheists in a foxhole. There are no atheists in a relationship with me, let me tell you. Because the fact that he is still sober is absolutely a miracle. And now he doesn't remember it that way. He's really sweet. I talked to him a few years ago and he said, you know what, I just remember you. I was so shaky and I had no idea which end was up. You really helped me. But that shows how sick he was. I didn't know that he was trying to stay sober one day at a time. I didn't know that he was trying to hang on without that bottle and without that security. And all I did was put him down and criticize and condemn and compare, all the C's they talk about. Don't criticize, complain, condemn, and compare. And that's all I did all the time. And the more I did it, the more I saw that empty shell of a man. The more I did it, the more I saw his posture change, the more I saw his eyes empty out, the more I saw, as I see today, I can see that when I go into a meeting and I see somebody with a practicing Al-Anon with them, and the practicing Al-Anon's with an alcoholic, but the Al-Anon won't go to Al-Anon. And I see that alcoholic who's trying to stay sober and live a spiritual way of life, who has to go home to an old idea every night. And I see how they look when they're with their AA buddies, and I see how they look when they have to go home to that old idea. And it's not pretty, and it makes me cry. It really makes me sad. And it makes me sad when I see kids that don't get Alateen. You know, why would we get this amazing fellowship and not send our kids to get the same gift? You know, what a selfish thing to do. But, you know, sometimes we just do the best we can, and we don't know till we know. And he wanted me to go to Al-Anon, and the more he wanted me to go to Al-Anon, you know, to this day, I will never tell an alcoholic that they need to go to AA, because the more he wanted me to go to Al-Anon, all I had was ego. I didn't have anything left. I didn't have any self-worth. I had no assets left. All I had was pomposity and ego and self-righteousness, and I know best. And the more he told me to Al-Anon, it would set me back at least 6 months every time. So I never bothered to tell an alcoholic that they need AA, because I know it's going to set them back. And I just figure, you know what? They're going to find it when they find it and when they're ready. And his sponsor told me, if you don't find a spiritual way of life, chances are you're not going to make it. And he was absolutely right. I took this self that I told you about, and I had done some violence to my little sister, and we had fought a lot when I was little, and I had this emptiness, and I had this, you know, looking for a fix, and here's this guy trying to stay sober, and he wasn't giving me enough attention, and he wasn't giving me enough love. And so I did some things that I swore that I would never do to get that attention, because like an alcoholic whose drink of choice may be vodka, if there's no vodka in the house and there's only scotch, it's not like they're going to say, oh, no thanks, I only drink vodka. Of course they're going to drink the scotch. And when I couldn't get my fix from him, I went on to do other things, and I sold myself out, and I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of. I had affairs with married men, and I tried to find my validation any way that I could, because if the vodka bottle wasn't there, I was going to have scotch or whatever my fix was. And for those married men, that was that was for me a double or triple shot, because I was so empty and such a vacuum that not only was I getting the fix that I was getting his attention, but I was getting that double shot because I was getting his attention away from his wife. And I was getting that triple shot because he was going to come to see me and leave his wife and his children. And I justified that, another one of my isms, justification. And I justified that behavior. And I said, I'm not committing adultery. I'm not doing anything wrong here because I'm single. He's the one committing adultery. I'm just a free-willing adult, and I can make choices today, and it's not my problem. And that's how I justified not having any morals, and that's how I justified selling myself out. And as a result of that, I also wound up in a lot of other relationships, and I wound up getting pregnant quite a few times, and I wound up terminating those pregnancies. And I'm not proud of that, and I've had to do a ninth step on that. And because those were the things that I did because it was more important. My AA girlfriends tell me that I should have been an alcoholic and stayed in the bars drinking because I would have gotten a lot less trouble. My problem was I actually went to the bars to meet men, you know. They all stayed there and drank. So I was doing anything that it took to try to make myself feel better. And meanwhile, I was tearing out pieces of my soul by taking those bad actions that a lady does not take and a lady in recovery doesn't take. And I'm sorry if those things are a little, you know, offensive to you, but I need to tell you my story in a general way. So I was feeling worse and worse and worse, and I was doing worse and worse and worse at this job, and everything was falling apart, and even my parents didn't want to talk to me, and my dad wants to fix anything. You give him a problem, and he will fix it, and he's a very powerful guy, and he fixes a lot of people, and he did not, he even said I was too depressed to talk to. And something happened, and it happened by the grace of God. I wound up, for whatever reason, breaking up with this man that I had been seeing, and breaking up with the married man, and breaking up with whoever else, and I quit my job. And I was supposed to get this other job with this guy who turned out to be this major drug addict who never got the show together, so I never wound up getting that job. But I supposedly was going to this other job, and the whole deal fell through, and basically I stayed in bed for months. I didn't go out. I only went out at night. When I went out at night, I wore sunglasses. I didn't want anyone to see me, like anyone cared. I was completely depressed. I was eating crap. You know, I'd order pizza. That's what I lived on. Or go to Save On and buy cookies. I barely bathed. I didn't brush my teeth. I was suicidal. I slept all the time. And really, really morose. I could live. The weight of having to pull myself out of bed was like pulling somebody, you know, a few hundred pounds out of that bed. I was so depressed. And one day, God came in such an unanonymous way into my life because the phone rang, and it was the day that I was going to kill myself. And I need to tell you that 3.5 years into this program, I remembered some of my past, and the reason I didn't give it to you in order was because I remembered it a lot later. But I had already overdosed once on Valium when I was in high school and didn't remember it. And it was nothing dramatic, and I'm going to show them or anything. I just found a thing of Valium in my dad's medicine cabinet, and I took it. And I thought, I don't want to feel this way anymore. I just want to go to sleep and not wake up. And I took it, and by the grace of God, I woke up on the bathroom floor sideways next to my vomit instead of choking on it because God had another plan for me. And he wanted me to pick up cups at a meeting. And I didn't remember that at the time. I just knew that I was at this place, and I was feeling my ribs for where I was going to stick the knife. And the phone rang. And I had stopped answering the phone a long time before. In fact, I had this electronic thing called a codaphone that back then was like a precursor to call waiting and all that stuff. It was an actual machine that you had to have a code to even ring through to my line. And then if I gave you a special code, which I didn't give out any codes, so except, you know, one friend maybe had a code. And then once you rang through to my line, then it would get my answering machine. I mean, that's high-tech isolation. And, you know, that isolation is the thing, you know, another one of my isms that kills me in this disease. It kills me in this disease. And I was feeling that it was where I was going to stick the knife, and the phone rang that day, and for whatever reason, I decided to pick up the phone, probably because I was going to kill myself. And, you know, this girl called me, and she said, I'm going to kill myself. I need you to drive me to a mental institution. And this was a girl who was dating another guy in the same band as my boyfriend. Now, I had no assets left. I had no you know, loving part of me left. I had no kindness. I had no compassion. I had no empathy. I had none of the things that we get here. All the things that I've learned from you by you guys showing it to me and me being able to give it back to you. I had no assets left. And this is how God works in my life, the same way that the program and all of you work in my life, which is he loved me for what I couldn't do, not for what I could do. And he took my defects of character and used them at that moment in time to save my life. And he took my defects of character at that moment in time and used them as assets, because he took my self-righteousness and my know-it-all and my smugness and all of that stuff. And I said to her on the phone, "Oh, you don't need to kill yourself. You need to go to Al-Anon. I will call and we'll go to a meeting." That's how I got to Al-Anon. The 13th of April, 1985. That's exactly how I got here. God totally used my defect. If anyone had said, "Maria, you need help. You need to go to Al-Anon. I love you. Come with me," I wouldn't have gone. That's the only way I could have gotten here, was to be better than somebody else and to have the answer for somebody else. And I got here, and I went to my first meeting, and I have no idea what they talked about, but I have a feeling it was something about the third step, because everybody was talking about God's will this and, you know, all that stuff. And they said, now at the end of the meeting, it's time if the newcomers have anything they want to share. And I raised my hand, and I, you know, Miss Self-Righteous, and I went, "Yeah. I have something I want to share." And they said, "Yes." And I said, "Yeah, you guys are talking about God's will this and God's will that. And if it's God's, if you're living God's will, you have a good day. And if you're not living God's will, you have a bad day and blah, blah, blah. You know, maybe it's God's will that you have a bad day. Maybe God wants you to walk down the path and stub your toe so that the next time you walk down that path, you know to be careful on that one part of the path." And they said, "Thank you. Keep coming back." And I really thought that I stumped them. I really, really thought I outdid these women, these little blue-haired women. I outdid every one of them. And this lady came up to me. She was 72 years old. She became my first sponsor. And she came up to me after the meeting, and she looked up at me, and she said, "You know, honey, it may be God's will that you stub your toe, but it's your will as to how long you want to feel the pain." And I was like, whoa. That is so deep. And I had absolutely no idea what she meant. But I knew it was so deep. And I had been, you know, going to AA meetings for all this time with my ex-boyfriend, and so I knew, you know, to get a sponsor, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And I was so crazy that for my first year, really, I had the Porky Pig syndrome, where I was just yabbity, 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 you know. And she would say, "Read the first three steps. Read the first three steps. And if you get bored, read the first three traditions." And I couldn't hear it. She just said that's all. I was so crazy, and my head was so crazy. I used to get up in the morning. When I was new, I was so depressed. I would get up right before the meeting. I would throw on sweatpants. I didn't bathe. I didn't brush my teeth. I had dirty hair. I'd throw on those sweatpants looking like a slob, and I'd go to that meeting. And if I was at all early, I would sit in that Alano Club in Glendale, and I would hold myself, and I would just rock. I felt like I was just starting to thaw, and that all the feelings and everything that I had shoved down, the violence that I did against my sister, the ways that I sold myself out in not being a lady, the fact that I remembered later that I had been raped on one of my jobs, and that I had shoved that down because I was so sick that I convinced myself that I wasn't raped, even though I tried to fight him off, that, boy, he must have really wanted me. That's how sick I was, you know? That's how sick I was. And all of that stuff, I would go to those meetings, and it was starting to come back. And it was starting, my nerves were starting to come alive, and I felt like I didn't have any skin on. And if I did have my skin on, I wanted to unzip it and have my skeleton go running, screaming down the street. I was so insane. And she just kept talking to me about the first three steps, and that's all she could tell me because I was so crazy. And finally, one day, I was following her into some coffee shop, you know, nonstop, this little lady. And we were right outside the coffee shop. There were these newspaper stands. And I was saying, "Yeah, but he this, and yeah, but he that." And, you know, I'm still talking about this relationship that's over, right? But, you know, with an Al-Anon, the relationship is never over. It's over when I say it's over. And Restraining order, be damned. No, that's where I have to go if I go back out there. Never thought of that. Anyway, the drive-by viewings to see if their lights are on, you know, it makes you feel better. You know, just picking up the phone, hearing their answering machine voice. A little drink, little shot in the morning, right? You need to start the day off with a shot. Let me call and get that little voice. Oh, okay, I feel better, you know? Then, of course, you start thinking, I wonder if he's home. Why isn't he home? Why isn't he answering the phone? Is he home and not answering the phone, or is he not home? I better drive by. His car isn't there. I better wait on the corner. I better check. In fact, I better move my car because then I can see the front entrance and the back entrance. You know, now I got to sit here till 4 in the morning. Now I got to start calling on my cell phone. You know, and you know those calls where they get more and more and more hysterical. You know, all the men in the room are sitting there going, "Oh, holy crap! I hope this meeting ends soon." This woman's really scary. Don't worry, the program works. Anyway, so one day I was doing the yeah, but he's, and I'm following my sponsor, and she turned around and she goes, "Look, I want you to go home and take a piece of paper out, and I want you to make some lines on that piece of paper." She said, "I want you to make 3 columns on that piece of paper, and on the top of the first column, I want you to put Maria's responsibilities. And on the top of the second column, I want you to put Rick's responsibilities. And on the top of the third column, I want you to put God's responsibilities. Stay in your own column." And you know, I got that. It took me a year. That's what I learned in my first year. But meanwhile, in that year, I had a coffee commitment, and I screwed it up, you know, but I did it. I had, you know, I take a little money, oh, I need money for gas, you know, oh, did I take $2 out or $3 out? All right, I'll just put $5 in, you know. I couldn't work, I couldn't function, I was going to 11 meetings a week for my first few years. It was absolutely insane. When there wasn't a meeting, I'd sit in that Alano Club, and I'd just sit there and wait and rock. And when I started to get buddies in this program, we'd go to coffee shops after the meeting. We'd go to coffee shops before the meeting. We'd make our own conventions on the weekend. We'd go bowling. We'd do everything. We were together all the time. And I got this big group. We crave that we'll create the fellowship we crave, you know, and it's right around us that we created around us, and that's exactly what happened. And so I was doing all those things, and even though I was crazy, everybody loved me anyway, and everybody just said, "Come on, let's go. Come on, let's do it." And I felt like I belonged, and I felt a part of, and I felt good for the first time in my life. And I had to put my relationship with my parents on the back burner for a little while because I didn't really know how I felt about it. And all my life, I thought my parents were pretty cool. And then all of a sudden, all this other stuff started to come out, and I didn't know that's part of the process of working the steps. And then my relationship with my parents got really good. And then it got really bad again for a while, and they really didn't like me being in Al-Anon because I wasn't necessarily jumping, you know, as fast as they wanted me to jump. And now my relationship with my parents is good. And my relationship with my mom is really good. And that's a result of this program. I kept going in the program, and now Francis told me to go based on the raffle time, so I'm okay, I guess. Okay. Okay. So, as long as an alcoholic tells me I'm okay, I'm like, "Oh, okay! Say it again! Not enough!" Say it faster, and I'll say it more sincerely. All right. Anyway, when I was 4 years in the program, I met an AA guy who was he was speaking at a meeting, and he was really funny, and he just you know, got me laughing, and that's the first thing that gets me going. And he had blue eyes, and they were all alcoholic and twinkly, and he showed that he liked me, but he didn't ask for my number and left, so that really made him a challenge. Anyway. Through some mishaps and manipulation, I wound up running into that guy again, and we started dating, and we were going to trudge the road to happy destiny, and I thought, this is it, you know, this is it. What I didn't know was I get to do everything in the program that I did out of the program. Maybe not everything, maybe not as bad, but I got to see my same patterns. I got to see all the ways that, one more time, when I feel bad about myself, I think that somebody else is going to fix it. One more time, when I feel bad about myself, I have to give you a little shot, you know, like talk about, you know, that we need to practice restraint of tongue and pen. That when I feel bad about myself, if I can make you feel a little bit bad about yourself, maybe you'll stay with me because you'll feel equal to me. And the more I did that, the more I felt worse, and the more he pushed me away. And the more he pushed me away, the more I tried to get his attention in positive or negative ways, and the less it worked. And I had to do some work, and I did a lot of inventory work. And I worked through the steps again another couple times, and I got to talk to some long-timers. And I was going through all this, and I was saying, yeah, but he, one more time, yeah, but he doesn't want a commitment. Been in this relationship 3.5 years, but he doesn't want a commitment. And I'd go to my friend Vinoy, and I'd say, he doesn't want a commitment. And she'd say, but what is it within you? Now, it took me years in this program to figure out that people that can handle commitment don't stay in relationships with people who can't handle commitment. Can you believe that? I thought that I could handle commitment, and I just had to force him into being the kind of guy that could handle a commitment. I was doing my commitments in the meetings, failing at all of them, but I was doing them. I'd done the service board, I had been a preteen sponsor, I'd done all this stuff, and I was supposed to be able to practice these principles outside in my real life. I didn't know that people that can't handle commitment or intimacy are the only ones who stay in relationships with people who can't handle commitment or intimacy. Because one more time, I didn't have to have both feet in the relationship. I could say, see, if he doesn't change, I'm out of here. See, if he doesn't change tomorrow, I'm out of here. If he doesn't change tomorrow, I'm out of here. So in other words, I had one foot in and one foot out all the time. I was always halfway out of there. All the while blaming him. I got to run out some of my other isms doing that. The need to be a victim. See what he's doing to me. He's pushing me away. Now, I didn't know my arm was up just as equally because I thought it was all him. I ran out my other ism, irresponsibility. I didn't have to take any responsibility for my part. And I didn't have to, and my immaturity. Didn't have to mature and grow up and know that I get to commit one day at a time for the rest of my life, one day at a time. But today I have to act as if I'm committed for the rest of my life, one day at a time. And I didn't get that. I was still trying to arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness sometimes, and that didn't work with him, so I had to try all these other things. And it didn't work. But meanwhile, I kept doing those steps, and I kept talking to these long-timers, and they kept helping me, and I was looking at my part in things, and I was starting to see things, and I was 7.5 years in the program at this point, a few years had gone by, and I heard the first speaker at a Mountain High conference, his name, Tom, and he got up there and he said, and at 7.5 years, I finally was able to let go of my need to be a victim. And I felt like an axe chopped me right in the skull and split my skull open, and my brain was right there. And I had a flashback of my whole life, not just this relationship with this man, but I realized that I kept putting myself in situations. If a job ended, it was because it ended and they were all jerks. It wasn't my fault. And I got to look at all of those little things that one more time, I was always the victim. You know, they talk about the Al-Anon salute, always like this. But I was so domineering and dominating that I never thought of myself as a victim. So I didn't know I sounded like one all the time, and that I acted like one all the time, and that I had a victim face on all the time. I just thought, I'm not a victim. I'm the one that, you know, tells other people what to do. I had no idea what a victim I really was, and that's when I really started to see how much you guys loved me and accepted me for who I was. And that relationship ended, and I was really sad about it, and I had been sponsoring a girl for 5 years, and she and I were best friends. And she was the first person that after she did her fifth step inventory, she looked at me and she said, do you still love me? And she said, do you still feel about me the way that you used to feel before you heard my story? And I said, no, I don't. I said, I love you so much more because I know so much more about you. And it was such an amazing bonding experience I had with this girl. And she became my best friend, and we went to meetings together because we lived in the same area in the valley, so she and I would wind up driving to our meetings together. Anyway, we were at a program function one night, and she got a headache. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, you know, normally we just say, oh, take an aspirin, lay down, we'll come get you, or whatever. And I looked at her, and the summer before, I had had unexplained headaches that they kept taking me to the hospital for, giving me spinal taps and all this stuff. They thought I was having an aneurysm. Spinal taps are very, very painful. Very painful. And I had no idea why I had gone through this stuff, but we will see how our experience can benefit others here. And it was all right and perfect plan, because the next year, a year and a half later, this girl said I had a headache, and there was a look in her eye, and I just knew it. And that was the one night she didn't drive. This other girl, Kim, drove. And I looked at Kim and I said, come on, Kim, we got to take Susanna to the hospital. And we took her to the hospital. By the time she got there, she had lost all muscle control and she couldn't speak. And we picked her up and we put her in the wheelchair and we wheeled her into the emergency room, and they were sure that she was overdosing on drugs. This girl had never taken a hit off a joint in her life. And she was 23 years old and she died. And it was just, I remember being in the hospital. I remember calling my sponsor, and I remember calling Dr. Paul from that hospital room, and I was just, you know, just in a vegetative state and not knowing what to do. But and her father really hated me because I was her sponsor, and I had given her some direction to not allow some behavior that had gone on, and he really hated me, and he really hated Al-Anon. And we were trying to get a hold of her father, because she was British, and her father lived in this country, and her mother didn't. And we finally got a hold of him, and he came to the hospital very early the next morning, and she was on life support, she wasn't on life support at that point, but she was definitely, she had had this huge aneurysm the size of a fist. And he said to me, as a result of this program, I believe, he said to me, I spoke with her mom, and she's flying from England right now, and we want you to be in on the decision on whether or not we pull the plug and whether or not we donate her organs. And I had, what was really strange was a few weeks before, we were driving to a meeting in Orange County, and she had said to me out of the blue about 2.5 weeks before, by the way, Maria, if anything ever happens to me, I wrote a note and put it in my jewelry box to say that you're going to be in charge of whether or not you pull the plug. And I said, well, first of all, Susanna, I'm not your family, so I can't be, I am the wrong person to make that decision. That's your family's decision. So, and second of all, you're asking the wrong person, because I believe in miracles, and I don't think I would ever pull that plug. Well, 2 weeks later, 2.5 weeks later, this is happening. And I went into her room, and we were alone, and I looked down at her, and I said, Susanna, you know, you've given me so much, and you've shared so much, and, you know, she was really, you know, they talk about the wind beneath my wings. You know, people thought of her as the wind beneath my wings, but I was really the wind beneath her wings, you know. And I looked at her, and I said, I can't expect anything of you, but I got to ask you one more favor. Your mom's coming, and I have to be in on this decision on whether or not to pull the plug. And if you're talking to God right now and you're in that tunnel, could you tell God that if you're supposed to come back here, we're willing to go to any lengths to take care of you. But if you're supposed to leave, I want you to know that I'm going to be okay, and we're all going to be okay, and it's okay if you want to go. And 15 minutes later, her brain exploded down the back of her neck, and she died, and we didn't have to make that decision. And so after this breakup and after this situation, I was feeling worse and worse and worse. And time was going on, and my sponsor was mad at me, and the group was mad at me, and I belonged to a group then, and they weren't real big on grieving or feeling feelings, and it was my old home group, and I just thought, you know, I don't know what's going on. I was, you know, I was on my 10-year surrender, which was a nightmare, and I'd seen a bunch of my friends drink after they turned 10, and I'd seen a bunch of people leave Al-Anon when they turned 10. And so when I was 9, I had made the decision I wanted to work the steps again, because I thought, they didn't leave because they turned 10. They left because of what they did before they turned 10, and I want to make sure that I have as much stuff in my spiritual, you know, armor or whatever, bank account, as I possibly can. And all of this stuff happened. And thank God, because I don't think I would have made it through the program as it was. But meanwhile, I couldn't figure out why it was getting worse and worse and worse. And it couldn't be. I know I'm grieving, but okay already. And one night I was leading a meeting at my then new home group, where I've been for the last, I can't remember how many years now. I think we've had that group for 12 years, actually. Anyway, that doesn't matter. But anyway, my home group, by the way, is the Stepped Up Group in Westchester, California, right next to LAX. So if you fly into the airport on a Thursday night, 8 o'clock, we're there. This lady came up to me when I was leading the meeting, and she said, you know, I don't mix my profession with meetings, but I have to tell you, you're really sick, and you're going to die, and you better go to the doctor. And then she told everybody in the meeting, because you know how we are here. She wanted to make sure I really did it, and this meeting is like a big family. Our meeting is about the size of this group right here, and we got a big home group, and it's really enthusiastic, and it's a very step-oriented meeting that uses the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the AA 12 and 12. And so she told everybody in the meeting, and they made sure I went to the doctor, and I went the next day, and I went to this guy, and he sent me to a specialist, and he said, yeah, you are in an advanced state of hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease, and your thyroid's so big that it's probably going to explode at any moment. You need to go across the street and get on the operating table and have it removed. And you could drop dead at any moment. And I don't know about you, but when someone says you can drop dead at any moment, my first thought is, I think I need a second opinion. And so I picked up the phone, and I called this other doctor that I had at UCLA, and he put me on the phone with the head of cardiology of all of UCLA. And this guy said, this guy's going to kill you. get out of there and come over here. And they took me over there, and they said if they had operated on my thyroid being that large, I mean, it was bigger than my fist, my whole neck, but I hadn't seen myself. I was feeling so bad. Never dawned on me to go to the doctor. Just these years had gone by, and I had been getting sicker and sicker and didn't know. I had lost weight. My hair had fallen out. All of this stuff had happened. But I just thought, what's going on? I tried to work the steps through it. But anyway, so they said, you know, your thyroid could have exploded on the operating table and you would have been dead. So, you know, anyway. So they started treating me. And for the next 4 years, they started treating me with massive amounts of medication and trying to get that thyroid down to the point where they could either operate on it or do iodine or whatever. So during that period of time, though, hormonally, I was so insane and so crazy. And the people in this fellowship loved me anyway. You guys loved me to pieces. You absolutely love me. I had the people that I sponsor leave me. I had a lot of people just find me really irritable, not want to be around me. God's getting even with me now because three of the women I sponsor are all going through menopause at the same time. So I know what it's like to be on the receiving end. And when I tell them I really understand, they know I really understand. And that's in the last few years, what happened was, as I finally had the surgery and I started to feel better physically. But I basically lost about 5 years of my life and got really fat, got really ugly, my hair fell out, and it was not a good time. And I did a lot of grieving of that. Of, you know, I used to be young and skinny and pretty and all of this stuff happened, and it was a tough time. It was a tough time. And the last few years I felt as though I'm shedding my layers, not just my layers of clothes and jackets and everything I was wearing over my huge body, but I was shedding my new skin. And one more time, I'm in at that new place in that program, like Frank talked about last night, that one more time, a part of me had to die. You know, a part of me went through, you know, that 15-year surrender. And I thought, oh, it's not going to happen to me. And then I was like, whoa. And one more time, got to get closer to God. One more time, focusing on the basics, showing up at the meetings early, being of service, taking commitments, doing somebody else's commitment if they don't show up, instead of just saying, they're not there to do their commitment, doing their commitment. Focusing on that St. Francis prayer, getting back to the basics that I learned here when I was new. And it has been an awesome 2 years. And as a result of that, or probably 3 years now, as a result of that, about a year and a half ago, I made a decision to quit the television business and to try something new. And something I had done for over 20 years. And I gave it up and I thought, I'm gonna pursue my dream. And I started writing. And I've been writing. And some of it's going really well and some of it's not going well at all. But I made the commitment I'm going to do this until next June. And at this point, I'm going to keep the commitment. And I don't know, I've been talking to my sponsor lately going, I think I overreacted. I don't think I should keep this commitment till next June. But that's the commitment I made. And, you know, one more time, you know, I'm not self-supporting right now. The credit card companies are not being self-supporting. You know, when you're living on them, you're not being self-supporting. But lost a lot of money in the stock market, all the money I was going to live on, all gone. So a lot of things happened that changed it, but there's something inside of me that believes in this program that I can go after my dreams. And I heard a speaker say once that that he wanted to pursue this, he wanted to go take this job, and he said to his sponsor, but I'm really afraid I can't do it. And he said, well, you have two choices. You can be 80 years old and sitting in a rocking chair one day. You know, you can either take the job and find out you're not good at it. That could be an option. Or you could be 80 years old sitting in a rocking chair one day saying, I wonder if I had ever, what would have happened if I had ever tried. You know, and I don't want to be one of those people that sits around. This program has given me that self-worth that I don't need to be fixed by other human beings, that I have that God in my life. I have tools here in my program to help me keep refilling that emptiness inside, because it doesn't stay. That's something that has to be maintained. You don't just come in this program and rest on your laurels, you know, like they say. The only thing you get from resting on your laurels are crushed laurels, you know. And I can live in the past as much as I want, or I can look to the future and dream and fantasize and everything when I go up and get my Oscar, but that's not reality. Reality is today, and God's grace is today. And today he's given me those tools. He's given me the 12 traditions to learn how to be emotionally and spiritually self-supporting in a relationship, not just financially self-supporting. To know that there's only one authority and it's a loving God in a relationship. To know that the unity of the relationship comes first, whether it's with my girlfriends, whether it's with my group, whether it's with my sponsees, whether it's in my meetings, whether it's in a love relationship, that I have to put the unity of the group first ahead of what I want and what I want you to do and what I want you to do to make me feel better. To relieve myself of that bondage of self, that selfishness, self-seeking, self-centeredness, everything with that four-letter word, the self word is my four-letter word, that it's all about what can I do to get mine and to make you do, you know, like it talks about in the third step in the big book. I don't want to live that way anymore. And that's not to say that I don't still get into that, you know, but I don't want to live that way anymore. And because of the program today, having a sponsor, going to meetings, working the steps, taking commitments, sponsoring other people, praying, reading the literature, and doing the things that they ask you to do here, you know, it's really not that much. Really, when you think about it, it's not that much compared to the fact that I have a life today, that I have friends today, that I have a family today who I love and they love me, you know, that I have a sister that got sober, and I don't know if she's sober today, that's her business, but she was sober for 17 months. The gifts that I have in my life today, the joy and the laughter and the ability to have people like me and to be likable at all, is a result of this program and the tools that you gave me in this program that enables me to live just for today, in the present, okay, in my own skin. And I really, really want to thank you again for your attention, and I know you guys want to get to lunch, and I really appreciate you being patient with me. And I love you all. Thanks for having me here.